Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Terrible Tommy. Tom Metzger. In the heartland, in the bunker. Right here in north central Indiana, transmitting to the world and all the ships at sea. And all the satellites up in the sky, baby. Yeah, we got the wolf calls going. You heard the wolf call in your community? If you have a CB radio, we'll put the wolf call on. Let's get them howling everywhere around the country on Channel 5. Yeah, right. Yeah. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And address your mail to occupant, box holder, Tom Metzger, insurgent, or whatever yanks your crank, baby. Yeah.
And the date is, let's see here, May the 14th, 2014. Yeah, May the 14th. Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. Don't forget, the 15th is the cutoff date for donations coming in. And unless you've made other arrangements or with old Tommy, well, you might not get the show for a couple of days until you get your donation in, you know. Tomorrow, yes, tomorrow is the deadline. Well, here's something of interest. People keep waiting for the war to begin in the Ukraine. But a 21st century style war has already begun here and may be almost over. Something that Vladimir Putin seems to understand, even if the rest of us do not. In a world where YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook dominate, the overt hard power of guns and bullets is no longer as publicly palatable as it once was. Autocratic states prefer to bankrupt dissidents instead of executing them. NGO workers are not disappeared, but their offices are shut down for zoning irregularities. Nowadays, even dictators have to be postmodern. Putin, schooled in the art of covert power, understands this new world, both instinctively and politically. To adequately comprehend what the Russian president is doing in the Ukraine, you have to travel across this occupied East, which is both a journey into a country falling apart and a gradual immersion in the realities of Russian geopolitical strategy. Across eastern Ukraine, city centers are now deserted. Checkpoints and barriers control the central thoroughfares, while shops and bars are closed. In the industrial town of Slavinsk, the center of the crisis, ATMs are running out of cash and the people wait in line for bread. Gun-toting men mixed with bored youths and old women while armored personnel carriers perform tricks in the road, skidding around in circles for cheering crowds. And a man can go from anonymity to self-appointed mayor in the space of a few hours. Moscow, through its links with the local pro-Russia militia and ex-president Viktor Yanukovych, former ruling party, as well as its dealings with the local oligarchs like billionaire Renat Ashkhametov, has ensured that normal city life has disappeared across eastern Ukraine. What has replaced it is a perfect mix of institutional chaos and public confusion that is day by day separating east from west. The pro-Russia protesters are violent and determined and occasionally organized, but they are politically and ideologically hapless, big on rhetoric but short on ideas. It was the same in each city I visited over the course of an intense 10 days. Russian flags fluttered from the barricades while amplifiers boomed out marching songs from the great patriotic war. Poor unemployed East Ukrainians reveled in their rebirth as armed revolutionaries. Told me they were ready to resist the fascist junta in Kiev and that Putin was strong and Russia great. These emasculated men and women, all yearning to be part of the greater, dimly conceived whole, told me endless stories about attacks on the Russian language, but nothing about how their lives might substantially be improved through an alliance with Moscow. In tandem with chaos comes lawlessness in the cities of Donetsk and Luhansk and Slovyansk. I saw not one policeman, not one, at any of the demonstrations I attended or occupied buildings I entered. My investigations, I became determined to find at least one cop in each city I visited, but my investigation always yielded the same result, the eventual discovery of a few officers loafing in groups or sitting in cars a few streets away. One night in Donetsk, the sheer scale of the problem became clear to me. I'd spent several hours with the pro-Russian demonstrators outside the occupied regional administration building in what had until that point been a low-key gathering, largely confined to general ill temper and anti-Kiev sloganeering. At around midnight, one of the two of the masked bat-wielding men who had been warming themselves by the fire built on the street suddenly became ignited. They'd clearly received some information and began to run to the side road by the building. More and more of their comrades began to run after them, and I followed. Turning the corner, I saw that what was now a mob had surrounded a bus filled with policemen parked on the sidewalk and were hurling insult at its occupants, demanding to know what they were doing there. Fearful of inflaming the situation, the police, largely young men in their 20s, remained silent until one officer tapped at a text into his phone and held it up to the window as the crowd surged forward to look. I caught a glimpse of the message. Quote, "We are the people," it read. "We are not going to storm the building." On the outskirts of Slovyansk, now the center of the East crisis, things reached their logical conclusion when I encountered a checkpoint on the town's outskirts manned by both pro-Russia militia and police. "What are the police doing here?" I asked the militia leader, a skinny man with a camouflage cap on his head and a crumpled cigarette dangling from his lips. "Oh, they're with us," came his nonchalant reply. "We are representative of the people, and they are the people too." The region still retains much sympathy for Yanukovych and his party of regions. Yanukovych is from the Donbass region, and his son, also called Viktor, remains involved in regional politics. Personal and political loyalty to the Yanukovych family is strong in the East, and both Donetsk and Luhansk are party of region stronghold. Pro-Russian protesters were invariably eager to let me photograph their party sweatshirts and raincoats. But it's mysteriously absent police who arguably matter more. Yanukovych had especially strong links to the police force, says Natalia Gumanyuk, a Ukrainian journalist and co-founder of the independent online TV station Horomsky. The police in the eastern Ukraine have been the most corrupt sphere of local government for a long time. They're politically controlled and on the payroll, unquote. Little surprise, then, that despite their numbers, Ukraine has 300,000 policemen compared with 100,000 soldiers. Kiev mayoral candidate and former heavyweight boxing champion Vitali Klitschko told me, "For the most part, the police have failed to even try to combat the unrest. It is merely the most egregious example of the truth at heart of the situation in East Ukraine. What remains of the Ukrainian national organizations and loyalties are cracking, dissolving, disintegrating." Well, there you go. That's a little look at what's going on in eastern Ukraine. I see that the Ukrainians are trying to cook up some kind of a new deal with the Euros, the EU. And they're going to sit down and talk it over. We'll see what happens. Well, former New York Times science writer Nicholas Wade has just published a book about race and genetics that has stirred up debates over scientific racism that go back over 250 years. Where did his ideas come from? Here are nine major works of scientific racism that are still influencing thinkers today. First, the definition of by scientific racism, I mean any argument that relies on the allegedly scientific ideas, whether genetics or phrenology, to claim that some racial groups are naturally superior to others. Often the scientific ideas of one generation are discovered by racist dogma by the next. But scientific racism has persisted for almost 200 years in the way we frame debate over race, with terms like eugenics replaced by new ones. Here are some major works that have helped create scientific frame for racist ideas. Right now, it's undeniably the Wade's work is the most influential work on scientific racism circulated today. His argument is that racial groups have genetic predispositions to certain types of mental skills, some of which evolved only over the past few hundred years. As a result, some races are more creative or intelligent than others. The Chinese, he argues, are more prone to obedience, while people from tribal societies in Africa are impulsive and quick to consume everything they have. Meanwhile, Europeans are good at becoming prosperous due to their thoughtful, forward-thinking natures. There you go. Well, his name is Nicholas Wade. I don't see the title of the book in the article, but it's something to you may want to look into. Oh, there's a movie that I think you would really like to see. It's not a happy movie. The title is Straight Into Darkness. It's about World War II and about two military army soldiers that desert, get lost, get in all kinds of problems, and then they run into a lot of other people along the way. And this film is excellent in showing how unconventional warfare can be successful, and how unconventional warfare can take on 100 times their number and still do a damn good job. Straight Into Darkness. I got it on Hulu. I don't know where you might be able to get it in your video store. Well, this is what I've been looking for a long time, and finally it's beginning to happen. Thousands of Vietnamese set fire to foreign factories and rampaged in industrial zones in the south of the country in an angry reaction to Chinese oil drilling in a part of the South China Sea claimed by Vietnam, officials said on Wednesday. The brunt of Tuesday's anti-China violence appears to have been borne by the Taiwanese companies in the zones of Bingdong and Dong Nai provinces, as rioters mistook the firms to be Chinese-owned. There were no reports of casualties, and the rioting appeared to have subsided by Wednesday. The row over the South China Sea and anti-China violence is tightly controlled. Vietnam have brought relations between Hanoi and Beijing to one of their lowest points since the communist neighbors fought a brief border war in 1979. Tran Van Nam, vice president of Binh Dong People's Committee, said workers initially held peaceful protests on Tuesday, but disorder broke out when the number swelled to about 20,000. Gates were smashed and rioters set 15 factories on fire, he said. Well, let's see here. F.Y. Hong, president of Taiwan's Formosa Industries Corporation, one of the companies that was attacked, said about 300 rioters looted televisions, computers, and personal belongings of the workers. Well, anyhow, that goes on and on, but, you know, what I'm saying is if conditions worsen in a lot of these countries, a lot of the American plants that were shipped out just to get cheap labor may experience the same situation, which would be fine with me. But they'll probably say, well, we got to send the military in now to protect them. No, no. If you want to protect your factories, where you bring them back here to the United States and hire American workers. Well, there is no joy in Jubil today. The Anti-Defamation League released the results of its new ADL Global 100 survey, and the results are informative, if bleak. The survey, which they billed as a comprehensive database research survey of the level and intensity of anti-Jewish sentiment across the world, polled 53,100 adults in 102 countries. One of the more jaw-dropping findings is that 26% of the people surveyed internationally, a figure which represents roughly 1.09 billion adults across the world, harbor anti-Jew attitudes. That's an estimated 1 billion anti-Jews in the world. Today, according to this world population clock, there are approximately 7.2 billion people in the world, 1.09 billion of whom apparently hate Jews. Wow. Also shocking is that only 54% of the people polled internationally had heard of the Holocaust. Another 32% of the respondents had heard of the Holocaust, but either believe it's a myth or has been exaggerated. That means that 2 out of 3 respondents fall into either one of those two categories, a supremely grim conclusion for international Jewry. Here are some of the survey's other findings. The most widely accepted anti-Jew stereotype worldwide is Jews are more loyal to Israel than to this country and countries they live in, unquote. Overall, 41% of those surveyed believe this statement to be probably true. This is the most widely accepted stereotype in 5 out of 7 regions surveyed. The second most widely accepted stereotype worldwide is, quote, Jews have too much power in the business world, unquote. Overall, 35% of those surveyed believe this statement is probably true. This is also the most widely held stereotype in Eastern Europe. Among the 74% of those surveyed who indicated they had never met a Jewish person, 25% harbored anti-Jewish attitudes. Of the 26% overall who harbored anti-Jewish attitudes, 70% had never met a Jewish person. 3 out of 10 respondents, 30%, believe Jews make up between 1 to 10% of the world's population. Another 18% believe Jews make up more than 10% of the world's population. 16% responded less than 1%. The actual number of Jewish people as a percentage of the world's population is 0.19%. Well, there you go. How do you like that? You guys think you haven't been making any progress lately? The Democrats and Republicans are always going off after each other. One, because of, the Democrats go after the Republicans for having this Adelson big shot in Las Vegas giving $90 million to Republican candidates. And then the Republicans turn around and attack, the Republicans for their love affair with the Koch brothers. So let's listen to a little Jon Stewart on this thing. It's pretty funny. First, we'll play what Harry Reid said on the floor of the Senate.
My guest, which, having hit some tough times, our democracy has been left with no choice but to sell its body to the highest bidder. Here's
the Koch brothers. The industrial magnates currently tied for fourth on Forbes' list of richest Americans with $36 billion apiece. In 2012, the Koch brothers' political network raised $400 million to support conservative causes.
Well, they raised $400 million. Found in the Koch brothers' conservative clubhouse couch cushions is probably. By the way, that club, each word spelled with a K. For $400 million, couldn't you buy your own damn country? You could rule any way you want. No pants Tuesdays, you could be done. Thankfully, one member of Congress putting his foot down and his dukes up.
The top Democrat in the U.S. Senate, Majority Leader Harry Reid, has now mentioned the billionaire Koch brothers this year more than 140 times.
They are in it to make money. An attempt to buy our democracy is dishonest, deceptive, false, and unfair.
It is wrong, incorrect, erroneous. Worthy of correction. That's where even the thesaurus runs out of ways to say. Listen, because the Koch brothers are in the fossil fuel business, their money can't help but pollute the debate.
Even the Keystone debate, Mr. President, they're one of the main owners of all that stuff up there, that ugly tar stuff in Canada. They are, if not the largest, the second largest owner of that stuff up there.
You know, in the history of the Senate, there have been many great and notable orators. And I truly believe that Harry Reid's vote against the stuff up there, Keystone Tube Dealey, will go down in history of the paper-ready thingies that are ordered on the, I'm going to say shelf-a-ma-jigs. Bring it home, Daniel Webster!
Senate Republicans, Madam President, are addicted to Coke.
A vast virus database has been updated.
You might say, Madam President, that their addiction to Coke is matched only by their insatiable love of dick. I think it's fair to say that a Republican utopia would consist of nothing but Coke and dick. Coke and dick. Dick and Coke.
I will proceed a little farther with this funny stuff.
Senator Harry Reid, crusader for good money-free politics.
A lot of people have noted how much time you spent on the Senate floor talking about the Koch brothers. But what makes them worse than, say, Sheldon Adelson?
Oh, snap! Harry Reid is going to drop that question like a 50-pound sack of dirt, root, starchy thingies. Sheldon Adelson, arch-conservative in Reid's home state, the owner of Las Vegas Sands Corporation, the country's single biggest casino company, including the Vegas Strip's only non-union casino. This guy spent millions fighting to outlaw online gambling, tens of millions fighting organized labor. In the 2012 presidential election, he gave $90 million to Republican candidates. Perhaps because he thought they'd help him take on, quote, the two most fundamental threats to society, namely radical Islam and unions. Yeah, that's right. Unionizing without secret voting is Sheldon Adelson's personal 9/11. Harry Reid is going to crush this guy.
So, Sheldon Adelson, don't pick on him.
Wait, what? Sorry, there. What you said? Don't pick on the billionaire who puts money in politics. Why?
I know Sheldon Adelson.
Yeah.
He's not in this for money. He's in it because he has certain ideological views.
What the f*** difference does that make? He's got ideological views. If those happen to line up with the money, mazel tov. All I'm saying is, look, well, what are his ideological objections to online gambling that the largest owner of in-house casino gambling has?
I can't tell over the internet who is underage. I can't tell who's got financial difficulties. I can't tell who is who is not gaming responsibly.
But if you come to my casino... if you come to my casino, you don't enter without answering a very detailed financial solvency questionnaire. Of course, assuming you even decide to come in after seeing my casino's slogan.
Have you thought this through?
For more, we go out to senior political correspondent Jason Jones. Jason! Jason! Isn't it? Let me say this. Isn't it hypocritical for Harry Reid to draw a distinction between Sheldon Adelson's money and the Koch brothers?
No. Do you want to expand on that? Or?
Not really. It's self-evident.
Why?
Because Sheldon Adelson's money and power help Harry Reid. The Koch brothers' money and power don't. So the Koch brothers are corrupt. Pretty simple concept to grasp there, John.
But you're just saying the effect money has on Harry Reid is what determines whether that money is corrupt or not.
Yes. Look, maybe some visual aids will help your dumb brain process.
All right.
Okay?
All right.
Now, here is the polluted piles of influence greenbacks that the Koch brothers smear across our democratic principles.
Okay.
Now, here
is
the majestic Towers of Liberty Bucks that Sheldon Adelson sprays like the sweet perfume of freedom on the taut, slender nape of our nation's neck.
You sound like you want to have sex with America.
What right-thinking citizen doesn't?
Listen, there's no difference between the two sacks.
Yes, there is. This sack is owned by a guy who's the biggest power broker in Harry Reid's state. God, you were almost comically dim with it.
So what? What is corruption?
Corruption is a billionaire who spends their money on you don't like.
What is free speech?
A billionaire who spends money on you do like.
That doesn't sound like a democracy. It sounds like we're living in an oligarchy.
No. Russia is an oligarchy.
What? What's the difference?
An oligarchy is a country run by billionaires who aren't American.
All right, thank you, Jason. Jason Jones, everybody. We'll be right back.
Well, there you go, exposing a little of that hypocrisy between the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson, the Jew out of Las Vegas. Well, let's look this one over here. Ukraine, we get all the tyranny we deserve. What do you mean by that, sir? Ukraine, this place feels familiar. I've been here before. Or maybe it just reminds me of another place. Was it Iran, 53, Guatemala, 54? Was it Congo, in 61, Chile, in 73? Maybe it was Iraq, 1990, or Iraq, 2003, or Libya, 2011, or Syria, 2013, or Vietnam, or. Something seems so very deja vu. Some regime that is not sufficiently open to the embrace of Western love, and then there are mobs, and then the U.S. government and the U.K. government and their allies suddenly see the need to do the right thing and help the public rid themselves of a corrupt ruler and enjoy vibrant, sunshiny democracy, no matter that this man was actually elected. The problem is, you can only believe that the West truly cares about the people of the Ukraine and their democracy if you have zero historical memory, or if your analysis of all those events comes from news organizations that don't ever really fully do their jobs. The U.S. corporate media never changes its spots after being tricked and lied to on Vietnam, the first Gulf War, the Iraq invasion, Libya, Syria, and just about everything else. It once again takes the U.S. foreign policy establishment at its word that it only wishes to do the right thing. The right thing. It bears repeating. We're told that the U.S. and its allies are just thrilled about people going into the streets to overthrow corruption and excesses of financial elites. Well, it's about time it happens here. We're long overdue. Yet when people tried that in the U.S., the police were there and forced to shut them down. Occupy looked a bit like the Ukrainian uprising, except that the U.S. establishment was desperate to crush it. Well, the ultimate in this, see our exclusive report on a suppressed FBI investigation into plans to use high-powered snipers to kill Occupy leaders. No, this is no joke. Also, as with Iraq, Saddam, Libya, Gaddafi, Syria, Assad, and so on, the West has a long history of getting rid of leaders who exhibit any streak of independence. Their dislikability is not the issue. The West has shown it doesn't mind tyrants at all, provided there are tyrants. It left those above-mentioned fellows alone. It did business with them until it decided not to. Meanwhile, there are the charming rulers of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the Gulf mini-monarchies, and the like. Well, in the case of the Ukraine, one thing is clear. Awful guy one, Yanukovych, was made a better offer before rescuing the plummeting economy by awful guy two, Putin, than by the West, awful guys 3 through 10. So he did what he had to do. He took a better deal. Plenty of people in his country have objected to his turning to Moscow for a lot of different and self-interested reasons. But one could argue that he made a prudent decision. One could also note that it was not unheard of that smaller countries try to maintain their close, friendly relations with a more powerful and aggressive nation next door. Canada and Mexico, anyone? One of the more popular media themes has been the blatant corruption of the Ukrainian leader. But before we trash Yanukovych for enriching himself, take a look at the splendor in which American presidents reside. And look at how comfortable our Bushes and our Clintons live after leaving the White House. Everybody benefits from the endemic corruption of the global system, except for the people who labors actually sustain it. Recently, the debate on the Ukraine has begun to move on to whether the opposition of Yanukovych is driven by civilized people or dangerous neo-Nazis and fascists. The problem with this debate is that even in a best-case scenario, with a clean slate of rosy-cheeked reformers in place, you'll have a new government that must turn to the West. West corporations, further isolating Russia and goading Putin to lash out. Then there's this little thing. Everything pretty much is about money. Follow the money. And not just Yanukovych hankering for the finest gold toilet fixtures. The battle with Russia, like coming battles with China and like just about every other intervention in the Middle East and elsewhere, is for control of energy supplies, the greatest source of wealth in the history of the world. It's worth noting that the Middle East is not the next big thing when it comes to energy supplies. The former Soviet Union is, and after that, it's the Arctic, where guess who is the West's biggest competitor? Why, Russia. Who blocked the impending coalition invasion of Syria? A wily Vladimir Putin. So you can recognize Putin for what he is, another egomaniacal tyrant, and still recognize that he provides an essential balance to what would otherwise be an unchanging superpower hegemony. If Putin and Russia continue to be surrounded and marginalized, the world will become ever more hostage to the whims of the wolves of Wall Street class that drives the energy industry, which in turn drives the policies of the White House, Downing Street, and other similar addresses. Ultimately, it is us, the citizens of the West, who lose big, like always, in allowing uncontested victories by this unelected alliance operating putatively on our behalf. We, the people, marginalize our own interests. We also ensure that we ourselves never break free of our own political corruption and maintain and remain unable to inaugurate our own real functioning so-called democracy. Yeah, I think I can go along with that. Sure I can. Well, here's an interesting story. An 11-year-old Negro boy was arrested after shooting his grandmother in the head. An 11-year-old Oklahoma boy allegedly shot his own grandmother in the head after he came home from school with an unsatisfactory report on his card. The boy gave his grandmother, Annie Mogul Walker, the report on Monday. While she sat reading, her grandson went and got a gun and then shot her in the back of the head. Quote, "He got in trouble today at school, so when I got home, I was going to talk to him furthermore about it. Before I could talk to him, all I saw was this big bang and flash and heard it, and I knew I was shot in the back of my head," Mojelli Walker said. His black grandma, although the bullet was still lodged in her head, Mogil Walker was able to return home to her apartment wearing a neck brace. Neighbors told KOTV that they were shocked by the incident. "All the kids in the neighborhood play together. It's so sad, very sad," said neighbor Jennifer Franklin. There you go. Watch those 11-year-old Negroes, boy. Well, whatever happened to that diversity love here? Headlines: Black and mestizo students attack each other at Chicago school. Six students at a suburban Chicago high school were arrested on Tuesday after police were called to break up a racial fight between Mexicans, mestizos, and black boys and girls. The lunchroom brawl resulted in a hold-in-place order at the Streamwood High School, and although one student suffered a bloody lip, no one was seriously injured. Well, next time they'll bring their guns. Police were called to the school after a racially inspired fight got out of control. Is a fight ever in control? No one is sure how many students were involved in the melee. Quote, "It was at least 40 kids, 40 mestizos and Negroes fighting. Then it traveled all the way up to the second floor. And they fought inside the offices," said student Deshaun Kavon, according to CBS Chicago. Quote, "The Negro Americans and the mestizos, they were just attacking each other today," said the student, Sarah Sullivan. One student says a one-on-one fight led to an all-out brawl. Well, I think you're going to see a lot of that as time goes on, boys and girls. A lot of that mestizo black fighting. There's a lot more of it going on than they're telling you in the news. Well, that old police state's gearing up. If you're a small town or perhaps a university security department, the U.S. Department of Defense has got a deal for you, baby. Thanks to the ending of the Iraq War, well, it was never declared, so how come you call it a war? The Iraq occupation, invasion and occupation, and the winding down of the war, invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, the Pentagon has 11,000 heavily armored vehicles that it has no use for, called MRAPS, mine resistant, ambush protected. They're designed to protect against AK-47s, rocket propelled grenades, and IEDs, And as pitchman Paul Richards used to say of the 69 Pontiac Firebird, quote, they're practically giving them away. Yeah. Correction, they are giving them away. All the local police department has to do is get itself an 18-ton MRAP, which originally cost taxpayers between $400,000 and $700,000 apiece, complete with gun turret and bulletproof windows, is send a few cops to pick it up and pay for the gas. There are a few downsides. Things only get 5 miles to the gallon. Can't go over most bridges or under them. They have a nasty habit of tipping over on rough terrain. For departments that find them too unwieldy, the Homeland Security Department is also offering grants to communities so they can buy smaller Lenco Bearcats, lighter, armored, military-style vehicles that run about $280,000. Since last summer, the police departments across the country have taken possession of 165 DOD surplus MRAPs, and there are another 731 requests for the 14-foot-high vehicles. Even Ohio State University police got their hands on one, saying it would provide a police presence at football games. Most of the rest of the vehicles to date have gone to smaller community police forces everywhere from Farmington, New Mexico to Hamburg Village, New York. The number of Bearcats purchased with Homeland Security grants isn't readily available, but they were on conspicuous display in and around Boston last year during the metro area-wide martial law lockdown while police and National Guard searched for Dahokar Tsarnaev, the wounded and unarmed 19-year-old student suspect in the Boston Marathon bombing. For the most part, Americans don't seem to question the use of military vehicles by their local police. That's because they're stupid. But some communities are starting to object. In Concord, New Hampshire, for instance, 1,500 residents last fall signed a petition opposing their town's use of a $258,000 federal Homeland Security grant to purchase a Bearcat for the local police department. The Concord Monitor reported that most of those opposing the purchase said they feared further militarization of their local police. No crap. Despite the opposition, the town government went ahead and made the acquisition anyhow. Screw you. Enter State Representative J.R. Hole, a Libertarian Republican who represents Dunbarton, New Hampshire, just outside Concord. Hole suggested or recently introduced a bill, the Police Equipment and Community Engagement Peace Act, in the state legislature. The proposed legislation is now in committee. It is passed and signed into law by the government. The state and municipal agencies in New Hampshire will be barred from buying or even accepting free offers of military-style equipment for police use, except with the approval of the assembled citizenry at a town meeting. The prohibition would include not just MRAPs and Bearcats, but also things like fully automatic weapons or anything that is not, unquote, available in an open commercial market. These restrictions would not apply to the National Guard. They can be armed to the teeth, man. Yeah. How do you like those apples? Well, it may look like we may get rid of the old Red Conyers from Michigan. God, he's been in there since the Garden of Eden, I think. If you don't know about him, check his voting record on about anything. He's in one of those safe voting areas where it's all black. Never take power for granted. No matter how long you've held a seat, you can still lose it to the voters. Or, in the case of Representative John John Red Conyers. You can lose it simply by not trying to run in your party's primary. According to The Hill, Conyers won't appear on the Democrat primary ballot because he didn't submit enough valid signatures from Wayne County Clerk Kathy Garrett. Said, it's my determination that in accordance with the current laws and statutes of the state of Michigan, the nominating petitions filed by Congressman John Conyers Jr. are insufficient to allow his name to appear on the August 5th, 2014 primary ballot. Wow, that's funny. Somebody screwed up. Conyers may now have to run as a write-in candidate despite having held the seat for 50 years after his opponent Horace Sheffield III challenged the submitted signatures and was ruled that two of the petition gatherers were not registered voters in Michigan, which the state law requires. Conyers' campaign had submitted 2,000 signatures, which was twice the required amount. After the challenge, however, he was left with only 592. That's because a lot of people will sign a petition and they're not qualified to sign it because they live in the wrong district or something like that. So you got to get three times the amount of signatures that you think you need because most of them get tossed out. That's right. That's going to be interesting whether Conyers could win a write-in vote. 50 years, can you believe it? Well, let's see what old Jim Hightower's up to today.
An old cliche says, hard work always pays off. Really? Ask a farm worker about that. Or talk to a McDonald's fry cook working three shifts to piece together an income that still leaves you in poverty. Work your fingers to the bone, goes the old song, and what do you get? Bony fingers. If it's a big payoff you want from a job, go for what my Uncle Emmett called soft hands work. I recommend hedge fund huckstering. These guys, and they're nearly all guys, never get a callus and do nothing of social value, yet they make the biggest haul of anyone. Last year, the 25 highest paid hedge funders raked in a collective $21 billion in personal pay, with half of that grabbed by the top four guys. Their billions are what's called unearned income, money made from money, not from one's labor. And it's not even their money. Other rich people, big pension funds, endowments, etc., entrust them with big piles of their money, which the soft hand guys then bet on such screwy financial products as packages of subprime mortgage derivatives. Yes, that's the one that crashed our economy in 2008. But even when they bet poorly, the hucksters get richer. For they charge what's called 2 and 20 to get into their casino game. That's 2% off the top of the millions of dollars a person or group turns over to the hedge fund, plus 20% of any profits made from the bets. So a guy like Ray Dalio, who runs the world's biggest hedge game, made a lousy showing for his backers last year, yet he still walked away with $600 million in personal pay. This is Jim Hightower saying, also, to further rig the unearned income game, the hedge crew is lobbying furiously in Washington to let them get away with paying only half the income tax rate that you working stiffs are assessed. Why do we even allow these worthless scoundrels to exist?
Well, let's check in on Max Kaiser and see what's up with the financial end of the business here.
Kaiser Report, I'm Max Kaiser. This past weekend we learned that not only is London home to more billionaires than any other city on earth, but also that there is so much cocaine usage here that the public water supply is tainted with the drug. The two stories are no doubt related, and not very surprising considering that London is, after all, home to all sorts of money laundering. But today we're going to talk about some more surprising information from the good old USA, 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 today. Stacey?
Max, that's USA Today, I guess one of their biggest newspapers in America. And I was surprised to go over to USA.com and look at this. That's a Bitcoin logo.
Well, yes, Bitcoin is going mainstream. As we knew it would 5 years ago, 4 years ago, when we first started talking about it, USA Today is reporting on what the world knows, that Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies, alternative currencies, are doing a serious push against the scoundrels of central banks.
And of course, the button did actually link to an article called Feds Approve Bitcoin for Campaign Contributions. The Federal Election Commission unanimously approved its use as a political donation Thursday after months of debate on the issue. So, however, the commissioners imposed several conditions, among them no anonymous Bitcoin contributions will be allowed, and campaign treasurers must scrutinize the donations for, quote, evidence of illegality.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, as a rearguard action, they will attempt to contain Bitcoin in a box in some way, but that's impossible, same way that they could never contain P2P file swapping. That totally transformed the music industry and continues to grow. Pirated, so-called pirated P2P file swapping is booming, and the intellectual property business, by the way, is also reporting record profits. So the idea that somehow file swapping online was going to cut into Hollywood's revenues was fake. That was folks. That was faux. That was false. In fact, the Hollywood...
an F word.
Yeah. You know, that went up. Yeah. So same thing with Bitcoin. Bitcoin improves the economy. It liberates people, like in China, who are now seeing that despite the government's attempt to clamp down on Bitcoin, the price is going up. That sends a signal.
Well, first of all, I think the absurdity is in twofold. First of all, we have the Citizens United case. So trillionaires from around the world can donate as much as they like. From around the world, not just Americans, anywhere can donate to American political campaigns. We don't know where their money comes from. Second of all, we have London. Nobody asked where all this money came from, where all the cocaine in the river came from. So, you know, the absurdity of focusing on just Bitcoin and saying that this is somehow extra illegality happens there.
Well, I mean, I understand why they do focus on Bitcoin, because it's a challenge to them. It's a competitive threat. And what happens with an entrenched oligopolist like the United States or Britain, they thwart all innovation and all attempts to undermine their entrenched oligopoly. That's what Bitcoin is doing. It's threatening them. It's threatening the command and control Communist Party in China. It's threatening all centralization with decentralization. And decentralization wins.
Well, Amir Tawke, who's been a very early advocate of Bitcoin, and he tweeted this photo of the metrics of the U.S. dollar versus any of the other altcoins. U.S. government has a 100% monopoly on mining. Mining algorithm, 8 white guys. Block reward, exponentially increasing ad infinitum. Double spending, institutionalized by banks. Security, proof of violence. Transaction confirmation time, slower than snail mail.
Well, Amir Tawke is one of the intellectual powerhouses behind the Bitcoin movement. Forbes recently identified him as one of the Bitcoin guys to most likely achieve billionaire status, if he cared about billion. I've seen Amir Tawke throw $1 billion into the Thames worth of Bitcoins and just not even think about it twice. He's beyond money. He's beyond even this world. So his words I take seriously, and he has obviously pointed to the fact that the fiat money system of the dollar is compared to Bitcoin, you know, what's the word we can use? Crap.
Well, again, USA Today viewers and readers, one of the number one read newspapers and hotels around the world, just like the Kaiser Report is the number one watched television show around the world, is all these people who travel are in hotels around the world, at airports around the world, that are going to have this sort of information about Bitcoin watching us reading USA Today.
Right. Well, I have some other Bitcoin, interesting Bitcoin news if you're interested.
Okay, tell us.
Just kind of a sideline, side note.
Go ahead.
Well, I noticed, you remember a few months ago, J.P. Morgan was trying to do a patented version of a cryptocurrency, and then their patents were thwarted by the patent office, and they said, no, you can't have that. Well, it looks like Western Union has, in fact, got a patent on a mimicking technology of Bitcoin. Now, I have maintained for years that the way that the entrenched oligopolists will attempt to stop Bitcoin is by claiming patent protection, the same way that Hollywood claims copyright protection. So that's going to be their offensive. Western Union, of course, which stands to be the huge loser, because you can move money overseas using Bitcoin for a fraction, for almost virtually no money, no cost whatsoever. So Western Union would be disintermediated out of existence. They've now taken the route, as I see it, as I perceive it, of going down the path of patent troll. patent trolling to try to stop this revolution from happening. They will fail, of course.
We're actually going to go into something similar like that, but first I want to talk about this other USA Today headline that accidentally made it to the front pages. Insiders get rich on IPOs, masses lose. So there have been 242 IPOs in the past 12 months alone, and investors who got the IPO price are up still 12.3%. But it's an entirely different story for the masses, though, who typically buy IPOs after they start trading. Investors who bought the same 242 IPOs at the price those deals closed at on their first day are trading are down 3.1% on average.
Well, the number of IPOs that this story would apply to 12,000 IPOs going back 30 years. In other words,
exactly.
This is the IPO industry, the initial public offering industry on Wall Street. Remember Frank Quattroni in the Credit Suisse case during the dot-com crisis? He was accused of laddering, buying stock in the aftermarket to force the price higher and pull in suckers. That has been with us since time immemorial. It's a classic Wall Street scam. This is not news. It only for a few days will it be news. Then it'll be forgotten, and then there'll be another wave of IPOs, and then people will say, oh my God, this is a scam, and then it'll be forgotten. And this is a cycle that I've seen and observed as a Wall Street insider myself for 30 years.
Well, I'll just go over one case because they do mention Twitter as one of the biggest examples. Twitter is perhaps the most high-profile example. Investors that got in at the IPO price back in November at $26 are sitting on a 23% gain. Those that jumped in and paid the first day closing price of $44.90, though, are down nearly 29%.
But it's been an established fact for decades that one does not stumble into an IPO on day one. That is simply not on. It has not been for decades. It never is. During a bull market, during an overheated IPO market, whoever buys something like this in the aftermarket on day one in this way, it is just completely born yesterday. They just popped out of the cabbage patch. They're probably kids. They're probably 9 and 10-year-old kids who have hijacked their parents' brokerage accounts, and they're buying Twitter IPO on day one. I mean, this is the next generation to get scalped by Wall Street. Of course, we need a new generation every couple of years to scalp.
Well, they go on the USA, 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 we're the best, we're the best, you can't beat us. Well, here's another story related to this, that it's all a hoax, it's all a fraud, no matter how much you say you're the best in the world. In fact, we know America is declining down the broadband penetration, everything, broadband speeds, broadband everything, it's going downhill, right? Well, beyond net neutrality from Vox.com, and they go over the fact of this case that everybody knows about recently, Comcast versus Netflix. Well, basically, most areas in the U.S., you only have one, perhaps two alternatives to get your broadband. And Comcast is the number one provider. Well, Netflix had to do a deal where they actually had to pay up and give Comcast some money, extra money, to make sure that their movies and television shows were actually playing without any slow speeds that they were being inflicted upon them. But the story points out that in a competitive broadband market, Comcast's gambit would not have worked. Here in Europe, with a lot of competitive networks to each home, that's a difficult strategy to follow, said Rudolf von der Berg, a telecom analyst at the OECD based in Paris. You're punishing your customers, and they can go to another operator relatively easy. And what has happened is basically Netflix has been given a private road. So the author of this article is saying that forget the fast lane. These are new private roads being developed for the big guys.
Well, they're subsidized private roads by the U.S. government and the taxpayer. Look, free market capitalism and oligopolization are mutually exclusive. They're not the same thing. Comcast is not a capitalist company. They're not a free market company. They're a pernicious, overriding oligopolist that's sucking the lifeblood out of the economy and destroying the Internet in any way that they possibly can. And if Teddy Roosevelt were alive, he would be breaking up these trusts, the trust buster of Teddy Roosevelt going back to the early 1900s. That's who Obama should have been, Teddy Roosevelt. He thought he was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He needed to bail out the banks or do some nonsensical, heinous act of corporate espionage on behalf of his banker buddies. But in fact, he should have been Teddy Roosevelt and bust up these trusts so that America could be competitive. You see, American competitiveness is plummeting down the global league tables. Infant mortality is rising in America. America is becoming a cesspool. It's becoming a dump because of this monopolization by a few predatory, larcenistic monopolists like Comcast. Comcast is the digital world, but Monsanto is to seeds and agriculture. It's an absolute albatross. It's a stone around the neck of innovation.
Yes, it is. And now they're also part of the surveillance state that has been able to spy on Americans. But Tim Wu, who they interview here, he's the one that came up with the net neutrality term. Well, he's at Columbia University, but previously he worked in Silicon Valley prior to 2002. And he says he remembers that solving a joint technical challenge, that is making the internet work as well as possible, was the predominant motivation of the engineers. That's still true in most parts of the internet, but some of the largest ISPs now seem to view declining network performance not as a technical problem to be solved, so much as a source of leverage in business negotiations. And I'd like to look at that around the world, not only in the business, not only in the like banking sector where we have a dilapidated system and you have to pay a lot to get a better service to move your money faster, for example. We have that in the NHS here where they just let the system collapse, just like they're letting the infrastructure of the broadband system collapse in America so that they can then go in to negotiate with Netflix and say, well, you want us to build an extra high-speed line for you, then you have to choke up the money.
Right, it's a subtle form of inflation to allow for this to take place as you've just described it, and unfortunately it has nothing to do with the free markets and everything to do with kleptocracy. So anyway, Stacey, you've got to go. Thanks so much.
USA, USA, USA today.
All right, stay tuned for the second half.
Well, that's it for today, boys and girls. We'll be back tomorrow, Thursday, and see what we can dig up out there. I'm sure there's a lot to dig up. How about that? 14-5 and shut up!
Ride this train to Dias, Arkansas. You see this cotton land? Some of us are poor now that you'd have to sell on a sack of fertilizer to raise an umbrella. They grade the cotton according to the length and strength of the fiber, and they've been raising a lot of fair to middling grade here, which ain't good. But there was a time. Yeah, there was a time when the cotton grew tall. Not far from here, I had the finest plantation you ever saw, about 600 acres of the finest cotton land in the country. Now, I believe this was about 1855, and I had a bumper crop that year. I had the best bunch of slaves you ever saw, and I treated them right. But a lot of them even stayed with me after the war. But getting back to what I was going to tell you, see, I have a rule that all the slaves got to be back in out of the fields and accounted for by sundown every day. And one day when they came in, there was one short. Well, I found out right away that it was old Uncle Moses that was missing. And I figured something might have happened to him, old as he was. So I went out into the cotton field to look for him. Well, Uncle Moses was way down at the end of the road, sitting on his cotton sack. Well, I walked up and said, Uncle Moses, don't you know the rule that you're supposed to be punished if you're not back in and accounted for by dark? And he said, Boss Jack, I know that, sir. But I was picking along on my road, and all of a sudden something seemed to come over me. And the finest words started coming through my head and the finest music. So I memorized them words and that music till I had it all in my head. Now that I got this song all through, I guess, Boss Jack, I was ready to take my punishment. Well, I didn't hardly know what to say, but I asked Uncle Moses to sing that song for me. And he stood up there, and for the first time, he sang Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. Well, after that, I kind of laid old Uncle Moses off and let him fiddle around the house. And every night at dark, you could hear him sing. And he sang another song once in a while that made me feel awful proud.
Pick a lot of cotton, drag a long sack. Coming across the field, well, I see Boss Jack. He's a riding straddle of a single foot roan. When you know that horse, you'll leave him alone. That old roan's got green in his eyes, mean as the devil and twice as wise. Fire in his nose and a bow in his back, Can't nobody ride him but Boss Jack. Come on, children, bend your back. Work a little faster, fill your sack. Then you hitch up the wagon, take it to the gym. Finish picking before the winter sets in. Now, here a while back, when the crop is laid by, remember who took us on a big fish fry? Caught a heap of catfish, goggle eye and carp. Danced and sang to the guitar and the harp. Well, someday old Boss Jack's gonna set us all free. Gabriel's gonna blow for you and me. Angel's gonna bring a chariot from above, flapping their wings like a turtle dove. Come on, children, bend your back. Work a little faster, fill your sack. Then you hitch up the wagon, take it to the gym. Finish picking before the winter sets in.